Good morning. Before I call the case for this afternoon, I want to explain a little bit about something that you might find a little bit different today. You each have been assigned 30 minutes by the court for your oral argument, and we give each side the same amount of time so that it's fair for both sides. And in the past arguments, lawyers have been really quite good about when the red light comes on, they stop talking unless they're in the middle of answering a question for a justice. We justices have not been quite so good. And there have been many times when one side has gotten to argue his case much longer than the other side. And we have become concerned that either you or the people who watch us on Wisconsin Eye might find that unfair to one side or the other, or might perceive that the court favors one side or the other by that kind of conduct. So we're going to try really hard to stick to the red lights today. So when you're finished, we are going to try very hard to be finished. So if you see me urging my colleagues along, it's because we want to be fair to both sides, and we want to appear to be fair to both sides, not just to you two here, but to those folks who watch us on Wisconsin Eye. So with that brief narration, we'll call our last case for today, DOJ versus DWD, and case number 13-1488. Counsel, are you ready? Please proceed.
Good afternoon, Justices. My name is Peter Fox. It's been my great privilege in this case to represent Joelle Scheiger. At stake in this case is the application and interpretation of what's known as the Wisconsin Whistleblower Protection Act. Now, that's an act that was created in 1983 and is found at Chapter 230 of the Wisconsin statutes. And the purpose of that statute was to prevent government overreach, to prevent government fraud and abuse, and allow employees in state government the opportunity to disclose when that is happening without the fear of retaliation for doing so. In other words, it's designed to give employees a vehicle to come forward with information when they discover that a law is being broken or about to be broken, and not fear retaliation from supervisors who take offense to disclosing that information. This is precisely what Joelle Scheiger did in 2008. Now, at the time, Joelle Scheiger was the best and the brightest in state employment. She was serving a probationary period as director of the Department of Public Integrity, of the Public Integrity Unit with the Division of Criminal Investigation, which is part of the Department of Justice.
What was her, again, tell me, what was her position? I didn't read that.
She was a director
of
the Public Integrity Unit.
Thank you.
What does that job entail? I couldn't find it in the briefs. And is it in the record of what her job was?
Well, she was one of four or five directors that served under the division administrator. And so she had various supervisory responsibilities over special agents beneath her. One of her principal jobs, and one that gained her national acclaim, was that she ran and really pioneered the department's Internet Crimes Against Children unit. So she had designed this with help from others, but she had designed this unit, which was the principal unit in our state to prevent online sexual predators and to discover them and prosecute them when they were discovered.
This is part of the integrity, Department of Public Integrity?
Yes. And Justice Abramson, this was something that she had been doing as a special agent in charge also, but it was part of her continuing duties as a director of the Public Integrity Unit. She had gained national acclaim for doing this and was considered a national expert in that field.
Didn't it have anything to do to make sure that the department was operating with integrity?
Well,
I mean, that's what it sounded like to me, Department of Public Integrity.
Certainly that's part of her position description, yes.
How do I know that?
Well, it would be in the record within her position description, and that would I can find that. I guess I would like to focus on what's really at issue here, which
okay.
is that the whistleblower
but if
statute
I could,
itself.
I would like to know what her job was. I think that has an effect on what she was doing.
Well, I can tell you what she believed her job was, and it was to promote public integrity, and that was her title. And in addition to the other duties that she had with the Internet Crimes Against Children Unit, she was also, as a director, supposed to warn her division administrator when things were not going well and when there might be some improprieties occurring. And that's what she did in 2008. Now, the emails that are at issue in this case happened in April. And I want to back up just a little bit to her February performance evaluation, which was just 2 months before that when her division administrator called her a star and a master of her job, one who didn't need any more probation. She should actually be permanently installed as a director and not have to serve the rest of her probation.
So they wanted to bring he wanted to bring her up faster.
Yes.
Change the terms of probation.
He said explicitly in his evaluation and in a letter to the Deputy Attorney General that Ms. Scheiger did not need any more probation to prove that she could do her job. This
Counsel, my three questions, whether I get back to them or not, I want to kind of get them out there. You need to address for me, is this disclosure? To me, the bigger issue is it information? And then finally, did she comply with the procedures in 230.81(1)(a) and (b), which says you report to your supervisor? Those three things are, if you could kind of address those, I think those are going to be fundamental to both sides' arguments.
Thank you, Justice Ziegler. Taking those one at a time, her email disclosed her belief that providing state agents as using state agents as security at a political convention outside of the state would violate OSER regulations, Office of State Employment Relations regulations. She attached the specific OSER regulations she believed they violated and asked her supervisor to look into it further.
Who is your supervisor?
Michael Mischewski. Now, she sent that email to Mr. Mischewski, who was her division administrator and direct supervisor, Cindy O'Donnell, who was not her immediate supervisor but was in her direct line of supervision, and to Jed Sperry. And Mr. Sperry was the person who had been put in charge of that security detail, so he was her supervisor on that particular assignment. So in terms of complying with the statutory requirement that she first informed her supervisor, she did precisely that, and the Personnel Commission and cases since then have interpreted that supervisors within an employee's chain of command meet the purposes of the statute.
I just want to get your answer to Justice Ziegler's question correct. The first part was, did she disclose? And so you're telling us the people that she sent the email to, is that disclose, as that term is used in the statute? I think that was the import of her question.
Right, but one of the questions I believe was being asked is whether or not she complied with the statute's requirement to disclose it to a supervisor.
Exactly.
And I wanted to cover that easily because
that
I think that's an easy
one.
Issue to cover.
That was the third. Do you think that's the easiest?
Well, I think it is easy, and I think the other ones, quite frankly, are easy too, but I'll get to those.
Okay.
The disclosure requirement requires that, and disclosure is not defined in the statute. What's defined in the statute is information. And information is defined under the statute as information gained by the employee, which the employee reasonably believes demonstrates a violation of law. Ms. Scheiger reasonably believed that providing these, using these state agents as security at an out-of-state event demonstrated a violation of OSER regulations and provided the regulations that she believed were being violated.
Well, but everybody else knew that he was going to use it, so does she have to have special information that no one else knows?
Well, apparently no one...
Is this public information?
No, this was information that was had just been disclosed at a department meeting, a roundtable meeting.
Okay, but there were people there that knew, right?
Well, and with regard to whether or not she was making information known to others?
Well, yeah. It's the employees gained information. I thought one of the arguments here was that if everybody knew this information, then it's not information that the employee gains.
That is one of the arguments. And my answer to that argument, Justice Abramson, is that what she was making known was the unlawfulness of what they were doing. She was trying to prevent them from doing something unlawful. Clearly, I'd like to believe that no one that had been involved in that assignment knew that it was going to be unlawful to do what they were planning to do. But if they did know it was unlawful, then my argument would be that this whistleblower protection offered by the statute should protect employees who try to prevent that unlawfulness from happening.
As I understand it, your position is that even if a lot of people had this information, that still means she has this information, and it's information that falls under the statute.
Yes,
your position?
And to be precise, Justice Abramson, my position is that she actually was making information known that wasn't known.
Okay. Well, how many people were at the round table?
The directors and a number of special agents. So I'm guessing, but probably seven or eight.
Okay. So they all know it. And Van Hollen knew it. Right?
But I'm not sure that, I guess, I'm not disputing that these folks knew that this detail had been assigned. What's at issue here is that no one knew that it was unlawful.
Okay, suppose that it was in the newspaper that he was going to the Republican convention and taking agents at state expense. It was in the newspaper. Everybody knew it. It was on television. Okay? That wouldn't stop you. You would not argue that that's not information, would you, under the statute? You'd argue that she still had information under the statute.
Counsel, can
I'm sure I understand the question.
Can I try to clarify something? I just heard something from you that light bulb went on that wasn't necessarily on before. The information isn't the travel with security detail. You're saying the information is her legal opinion that doing so is unlawful.
Exactly.
There's a difference. I think people were considering the information to be the travel with security versus you're saying the information is her legal opinion about that conduct being unlawful.
Yeah, or the information is her belief that the use of state resources in this way was unlawful, constituted a violation of OSER.
Oh, it doesn't matter how many people know it.
It doesn't matter how many people knew about the detail. What matters is that this unlawfulness was being disclosed, this waste of
I understood
resources.
That was an argument on the other side. If a lot of people know it, it's not information.
Right. And the response is that either they did not know that it was unlawful or they knew that it was unlawful and were going to go ahead and do it anyhow. Right. And either way, this whistleblower protection should apply when an employee is trying to prevent this kind of abuse by this misuse of state resources by government employees or this misuse of taxpayer dollars to pay for security at a out-of-state convention.
So what is the disclosure under the statute?
What is the disclosure? The disclosure is the unlawfulness of this planned activity.
Well, disclosure and information. I think you're saying information is her opinion of its unlawfulness. The disclosure would be the email. Right.
Precisely. Two emails. And actually, the two emails show that her supervisor did not know. He didn't even know what the complaint she was raising was, because she wrote this email explaining that her belief that OSER would be violated by doing this. And he responded saying, thanks for your concern, but I must point out that I don't think that these agents would be participating in improper political activity. And she responded again and said, that's not what I'm saying. My concern is that we're using state resources in a way we're not supposed to be using them. In other words, we're using state employees and paying them on state time to provide security at an event that is not being sponsored by the state and it's not something that they're state employees or representing the state at.
Mr. Fox, if everybody knew the information about the Attorney General traveling and the plans for DCI agents to provide security, why isn't the content of the two emails, which are, as you're very well aware, stated in somewhat of the conditional, I am concerned that this may violate OSER, and then the next one, the concern, and then there's a comparison to the Jensen case and the Qualic case. If everybody knew the fact of the plans for the Attorney General to travel and for the agents to provide security, why isn't this simply a matter of your client's opinion as opposed to information?
Well, I think we look at the statute. Thank you, Justice Gableman, but I think we look at the statute itself, which defines information as information that the employee reasonably believes demonstrates a violation of a law.
I'm always suspicious when I hear a definition that contains the word being defined, and that's a little bit at odds with you telling us a few minutes ago that there was no definition of information contained within the statute.
No, I said that there's no definition of disclosure.
All right. Well, so opinions, in your, the rule that you would like us to enshrine in an opinion would include that when an employee offers an opinion in regard to known facts, that is protected under the whistleblower statute.
Well, I think that, yes, if an employee offers a belief that a law is going to be violated by a planned government activity, I think that belief is, I don't think there's any other way to read the statute that protects belief.
Do we take into, under your, I understand your view. Thanks. And I didn't mean to cut you off if you were going to go further. But does your view, and I guess more importantly from where I sit, should the court's opinion take into account or take into consideration the conditional way in which, to use your client's word, the concern is expressed, as opposed to a matter of fact, a statement of fact? I have a concern about something. Well, then whose job is it to, well, let's, before we go there, should our opinion, whatever it is that comes out of this case, take into consideration that it was expressed as a matter of concern?
I believe yes, to answer the question succinctly.
Why?
Because if an employee has a concern that a law is going to be violated by doing something and tries to advise the supervisor as diplomatically as she possibly can without griping or complaining, but chooses the word, I have concerns, rather than, hey Mike, what you're doing is unlawful, you shouldn't do it. Instead say, I'm concerned that this is going to violate OSER. I don't know how we can't protect that.
There is, as far as I understand it, no cause to guess your client's good faith here. What happens in the next case where there's simply flat out no basis for any kind of concern along those lines? Still protected?
No, I think the courts have handled other cases. The ones that have been cited in this case have handled issues like that.
Why wouldn't it be protected?
Well, it would have to fit within the parameters of the statute to be protected. It would have to express a reasonable belief that a law is being violated. That's what Ms. Scheiger did. That's not what the employees in the earlier cases that have been cited in this case have done or did. Ms. Scheiger meets the statute, and I think I certainly understand that this is going to set some precedent for how the Whistleblower Protection Act is going to be interpreted. And we're very mindful of that, but also the danger of setting the opposite precedent is that we're going to remove any vehicle for someone like Ms. Scheiger to prevent unlawful activity from happening. Because by the rulings of the lower courts, what they've stated is that you have to disclose a fact. You have to disclose a fact of wrongdoing happening. Beliefs are not protected. Opinions are not protected. Concerns are not protected only facts. Well, the fact is that she was really disclosing a fact. The fact was that this planned activity violated OSER, and she was concerned about that. And her efforts were to try to prevent that unlawful activity from happening, try to prevent that waste of taxpayer dollars by sending state agents to Minnesota to provide security, and also to prevent scrutiny of the department itself when it was discovered by the public or when it was put in a newspaper. So, you know, on a case-by-case, but we always have to take these on a case-by-case basis, but I think in this case, certainly, number one, what Ms. Scheiger did was disclose a reasonable belief that a law was being violated. And number two, the precedent that has to be set here is that, at least I think, we want a whistleblower protection that's going to allow state employees to prevent abuse or fraud or waste of taxpayer dollars rather than wait until it happens and then raise your hand.
Okay. The standard that I've heard you articulate several times is a reasonable belief, as so long as the employee articulates a reasonable belief. Where is that language coming from?
Straight from the statute.
Okay.
It's from the defined definition of information, isn't it?
Yes.
Subsection 5, which defines information as information gained by the employee, which
you can write her a check as co-counsel as soon as the hearing's done, sir. Please go ahead. Answer the question.
Well, it's defined as information means information gained by the employee, which the employee reasonably believes demonstrates a violation of any state.
Okay, so we have two parts there. We have the information, right? Okay. Which everybody knows. Here everybody knows. It could have been in the newspaper for all we know, right? As Justice Abrahamson asked.
But it wasn't.
But it was 7 or 8 people knew, at least. Yes?
And they knew that the security was going to be supplied, or that was the plan to provide security. What they didn't know is that security...
You're not reading that definition in two parts at all. You're just saying the reasonable belief is the information, as Justice Ziegler pointed out. You're not requiring... Your reading of that would not include a construction that would say a disclosure of the information itself, which the employee has a reasonable belief. Because here we know the information has been disclosed to half a dozen or more people. It is simply the part of the belief. It's the part of the belief expressed, right?
Well, I'm not sure I understand the question. What you're suggesting is that she didn't disclose anything because everyone knew about the security detail?
Sure. Let's start there.
Okay, well, and as I stated earlier, what she disclosed was not the existence of this security detail. What she disclosed was its unlawfulness.
Okay. Right. Her
belief. Made that known?
Yes. Okay. I'll tell you what. You have done a good job of helping to clarify your position on this, and I thank you.
Thank you.
Let's take a look, then, at the emails that were sent and the accompanying OSER memorandum. So the email of April 23rd, 2008, at 11:11 a.m. reads, "To clarify, the concern is not regarding agents participating in political activity. Rather, can state resources be used by the AG at a political event where he is not representing DOJ, rather the Republican Party?" Parallel issues came up in the Jensen Koala investigation. Thanks for looking into this further. What was the reference to state resources being used? Where does that language or concern or question come from?
State resources?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the agents themselves, using state agents and paying for state agents to provide security at a non-state function.
Doesn't the OSER rule that she sent have reference to use of state resources? I'm referring to Appendix 086, and that states, in part, a prohibition of using state resources or alerting about the concern of using state resources for non-governmental matters. So I'm trying to tie in these emails with the OSER memo that she sent, and I might be wrong on this, but I thought that's where she got the reference to state using state resources improperly.
I believe you're right. Yes, that's exactly it. And she referenced 6H and referenced overall the general prohibitions against, you know, using state resources at off-state for non-state events. And that's also found in the general prohibitions. I mean, there's a number of them that are directly or indirectly implicated by doing something like this, and that's why she provided the whole memo itself.
H, you make reference to that. What does that prohibit?
That was the only section she actually cited in her emails to Mr. Mischewski, and that reading 6, being a member of a political party and participating in party affairs, this is what you can do, provided he or she is off-duty and not on state property. And H is serving as a delegate, alternate or proxy to a political convention. I think what she was saying to Mr. Mischewski is that they actually were not going to be off-duty. They were going to be on-duty at a political event, and they were going to be being paid as if they were on-duty at something that was at a political event, and that's why this particular provision would be implicated.
What about 5? That defines information, says information gained by an employee, which the employee reasonably believes demonstrates 5B, mismanagement or abuse of authority in state or local government, a substantial waste of public funds, or a danger to public health and safety. I don't see any danger to public health and safety, but it's arguable that it's an abuse of authority to use state-paid employees for a political event. And it's arguable that that constitutes a substantial waste of public funds.
And I notice that my light is red here. I would like to address that, though, and just say that has been argued throughout this case, that this has been a misuse of state resources. It's not just the violation of OSER, but a misuse of resources has been a fundamental aspect of the argument that we've presented throughout this case.
And that comes under the definition of information here.
Exactly.
On that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Wynn Collins, Counsel for Petitioner, Respondent, Department of Justice. The Department respectfully asks this Court to affirm the Court of Appeals' decision and thus affirm the decision and order by the Circuit Court. Your Honors, this case is about Wisconsin's whistleblower statutes and the Wisconsin legislature's careful calibration of competing balances between interests of the employee, the employer, and the public. As this Court explained in Hudson, the whistleblower statute only protects certain disclosures made a certain way. Your Honors, this Court should affirm because Shiger did not comply with 3 of the whistleblower requirements. First, she did not disclose information. Second, she did not disclose information to her supervisor before disclosing to another. And third, she did not have a reasonable belief to demonstrate a violation of state law, rule, or regulation. As this Court explained in Hudson, when an employee does not comply with the requirements, they are not entitled to whistleblower protection.
This is just a technicality, but oftentimes the threshold questions frame the paradigm of analysis. How's that for a fancy term? And that is, I think in these cases, we don't really review the Court of Appeals opinion. Don't we review the decision of the administrative agency?
You are correct that we have de novo review, Your Honor, and look to the agency. However, in this case, we also have no deference to the administrative agencies. So I understand your
point. It's not the typical kind of case where we are looking and reviewing. You know, is the Court of Appeals correct? I mean, it's not exactly that. Our law requires, or our precedent demonstrates, that what we're really reviewing here is the decision of the administrative agency, ERD, the Department of Workforce Development, and its division, ERD. And so that sets up a paradigm of a threshold question of what kind of deference is due to this. We don't have those kind of questions in the normal case in terms of a Court of Appeals review, but we do in this kind of a case. So can you address that threshold question of how much we should be embracing them?
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, it is not much different than a typical case that you describe, and the reason is that it is not only de novo review, but no deference is warranted. The issue of deference was litigated by the parties in the Court of Appeals, and it was a disputed point. The Court of Appeals said that it was de novo, and in the petition for review that Ms. Scheiger filed with this court, she never challenged that aspect, nor did she raise that issue in either her brief in chief or reply.
I normally think of de novo as something a little different, but just slicing it narrowly, than the whole no deference issue. In other words, we usually speak in terms of, is there deference, is there great weight deference, is there due weight deference, is there no deference. If there's no deference, then we get our de novo. So help me. So you're saying there is no deference here. Tell me why there is no deference.
There's no deference, Your Honor, first because it's not an issue on appeal. It was not raised by Ms. Scheiger in her petition. It was not briefed by her. I did have a short section on it simply to make sure we're all on the same page, and the reply certainly confirmed there was no challenge. The Court of Appeals, frankly, laid it out rather succinctly. No deference was due. It wasn't only the appropriate standard, but in this case, there was nothing on which to rely for deference. The administrative law judge did not interpret the meanings of the words at issue. It essentially punted and said they're ripe and properly before the administrative law judge, but those issues can be taken up on appeal. So the question is, how do we give a decision deference that punts on the question that this court is now deciding? And so that was the point of the Court of Appeals and why no deference was due. But if we look now to the crux, the three issues that I identified, Your Honor, if we look at the first point, an employee must lawfully disclose information. And what we know from 230.80 sub 8A as well as 230.81 sub 1, The employer or employee here has to disclose information. The department asked this court to do a rather straightforward analysis of the phrase disclosed information and apply the common and understood meaning to those terms.
What does that mean?
We identified several definitions that would be consistent with the common and understood term. If we break it up and we look at disclosed, Black's Law Dictionary says it's to reveal or make something known to the public. If we look at Kimmett's, which relied upon the New Oxford American Dictionary, it identified a disclosure as the act of making secret information known. When we also then look to information, I think this is a good point that Justice Gabler pointed out. It's a bit of an autological word with the way the statute defines it. It defines the word with itself. If you read the first opening letters, it says information means information.
Well, I then properly characterized your argument. Your argument, as I understood it from your brief on page 22 and 23, is that there's no disclosure of information. And there are two words there, but you put them together. There's no disclosure because this information was previously known. They already knew about the event and situation. And the department had memorialized the information in minutes to the meeting held on April 15. Scheiger did not disclose information because her supervisor and the other people already knew the facts. So your position, if I understand it, is there's no disclosure of information, putting the two words together, if others know about it, if the supervisor already knew it. And the information is that they were going to the Republican Party convention. The information is not that she thought it was illegal.
Correct, Your Honor.
You and your opponent drastically disagree on that.
Yes, but the difference is the department not only looks to the common understood definitions, not only relies upon dictionary definitions. When we look to decisions such as Kahn versus Department of Justice, it addresses this exact issue and states, quote, we have generally defined the term disclosure to mean to reveal something that was hidden and not known. Moreover, the disclosure must pertain to the underlying conduct rather than the asserted fact of its unlawfulness or impropriety.
So now your position is that this was not hidden information. It was known, and your position is that that it might be illegal is not disclosing information.
Correct, Your Honor, and that's consistent with the common understood terms, the dictionary definitions, the case law.
Oh, come on. It may be inconsistent with the case law, but if you ask people in this audience or go downstairs into the rotunda, if we were able to go there today, or other places around the square and ask if that's their uncommon understanding of the definition of what it means to disclose, that is, you know, dealing with deals with the underlying conduct. I mean, you know, not new, you know, secret. I mean, you may be right in case law. I'm not saying you are or aren't, but really, tell me what you think is the common definition that you're proposing for the word disclose. And I'm going to take it down carefully, so give it to me in all of its iterations.
It would be to reveal or make something known to the public. It is the act of making secret information known.
What about you used in your briefs new information, in your argument, new information?
Well, that comes within the definition of disclosure. The newness of it is the disclosure. The information is what is known as the facts and figures. And I want to raise 2 points to address the issue you raised. First, the common person understanding. Maybe if we phrase it slightly different, it might be a bit clearer. If I went up to a person in the public and said, have I disclosed something to Attorney Fox if I tell him something he already knows? I think the common person would understand, I haven't disclosed anything to Attorney Fox by simply telling him what he already knows.
How does your argument change, if at all? A lot of legal argument and a lot of life is depending on your focus, what lens you're using. How does your argument change, if at all, if what we're talking about is information regarding potential illegal conduct as opposed to attendance at the Republican convention?
That gets to the second point of the two issues I wanted to raise with you. The problem with the interpretation by Ms. Scheiger is she's going beyond the statute. She's asking this court to rework it, retweak it, and rewrite it. The reality is the legislature was entrusted with balancing these competing interests between the employer, the employee, and the public concern. And the legislature has used a phrase not unfamiliar to this court about reasonably believe. And reasonably believe is a term of legal art, and it is used as a legal threshold. And this gets to Justice Gableman's point about the autological information means information. What we have is two distinct requirements, and what this court has said in Hudson is these requirements serve a purpose. They serve the legislature balancing the competing interests. And it was the legislature's decision to create a reasonably believed threshold, and that's to balance the other interests, the employer and the public, against the employee.
Well, is it that she didn't reasonably believe? Because information is defined, and it says information, but that's not unusual in statutes to define the word and then use it again. It says information gained by the employee, which, and that modifies information, which the employee reasonably believes demonstrates a violation of law, right?
Mm-hmm.
So here, maybe everybody to whom she sends this information knows about the use of these agents at the Republican convention. But you need more than information that everybody knows. You have to have an employee who reasonably believes. Is your argument that she didn't reasonably believe that there was a violation?
Yeah, that was the third point, but I can address it now. Hudson says it lays out specific requirements, one of which is the disclosure of information, and we've addressed that. Another requirement, and this is to once again balance the competing interests, is the reasonable belief requirement. And reasonably believe is not a phrase unfamiliar to this court. It's in the statute at many places, and it is used to say not everybody can benefit from this statutory entitlement or this defense. And in the context of whistleblowing, what we have is reasonably believes is a threshold requirement. We look at the employee's subjective belief, and then we see what was that subjective belief, and was it objectively reasonable?
Okay, what was her subjective belief?
Well, there was two essentially, Your Honor, but only one was addressed in oral arguments, although a third was sort of raised in both the brief and during oral arguments. So let me break them up, starting with the issue which isn't before this court. A point you raised, Justice Abramson, was about the mismanagement, and that would be the sub 5B claim. However, that is not before this court. The administrative law judge on page 25 of the decision found only that Ms. Scheiger disclosed information as defined in 230.85A. So if Ms. Scheiger was unhappy with the administrative law judge removing a 5B claim, then she could have filed a petition for review. But the mismanagement and those things that are sort of sprinkled in the brief or were raised in oral argument a moment ago are not part of the administrative law judge's finding as identified on page 25. So
we're looking to see if there was a violation of federal or state law, rule, or regulation. So you're arguing she didn't have a reasonable belief that there was such a violation. Is that your argument?
Yes, Your Honor. And she identified two. So we look to her subjective belief, and it's the two she identifies. One is the one you heard about the OSER bulletin. Then there's a very brief passing reference in her email about 946.12 sub 3. But a key point to emphasize is that second email. I believe it was Justice Bradley who read it. Ms. Scheiger said her reasonable belief is not against the agents, it is against the Attorney General. So it is clear that her subjective belief was not that any agents were violating the OSER bulletin. It was that the Attorney General was violating the law or a rule or regulation. So when we look to the OSER bulletin, which Justice Bradley had identified in the appendix, it is clear that it applies only to classified employees. It says it several times. It's in the title. It's, I believe, in the opening line. And it is undisputed that the Attorney General is an unclassified constitutional officer. So when we get to the objective part, we look and we say, would a person of reasonable prudence believe what Ms. Scheiger believed? And so it is the Department's position that a person of reasonable prudence would not believe that an unclassified employee is bound by a classified bulletin. That belief is simply not objectively reasonable. If we look to the very brief and passing mention where Ms. Scheiger accused the Attorney General of committing a Class I felony, she says, oh, by the way, he might be violating state law, and then includes an annotation to Wisconsin Statute 946.12 sub 3. And what that says is by an act or omission, the officer in an official capacity exercises a discretionary power in a manner inconsistent with the duties of that officer. So now when we apply the objective belief, what would a reasonable person in her position believe, we walk through and look at it. Here, Scheiger doesn't accuse the agents. She makes it explicitly clear in her second email. She is saying, I believe the Attorney General is committing a Class I felony. However, she never alleges, asserts, or even identifies any exercise of discretionary power by the Attorney General, which is required under the second element of misconduct in office. And perhaps more bluntly, she never even alleges that the Attorney General knows of the security detail. So what we have is Ms. Scheiger stating that DCI Bureau directors, including Mel Schusky, and then that Sperry and O'Donnell know about this. But what we have at best is a hunch, and is undisputed in case law by this court when interpreting things such as reasonable suspicion and reason to believe, which is even a higher standard, a hunch doesn't cut it.
Well, I don't know. We have a number of cases that we've been dealing with in terms of even if she's wrong, if it's a mistake of law, that doesn't doom the claim, but that doesn't doom many times the prosecution of the case. So even if she were mistaken that the Office of State Employee Relations regulation or memo, I guess, even if she were mistaken that it applied to an elected official, is that the death knell then of any claim of retaliatory firing?
Your Honor, the short answer is it depends. And this goes to the analysis. We look at the subjective belief, and then we look at the objective component. You are correct, Your Honor, that a person could be mistaken and still have the objective belief. But we are bound by what Ms. Scheiger has presented. And so if we were to accept her interpretation that simply saying I believe is enough, then you would have the subjective component completely subsume the objective. And it would undercut what this Court has done in the past when looking at reasonably believes and the objective requirement.
One of my concerns is, what has the legislature said about this? The legislature has said in enacting the statute, and they don't do this all the time, but here they said, we want you to know, people, and we've put it in our statute, 230.01 sub 2, what is the policy of the state? And, of course, that helps a court or others interpret what is meant by the legislative enactment, what's meant by the statute. It is the policy of this state to encourage disclosure of information under subchapter 3 and to ensure that any employee employed by a government unit is protected from retaliatory action for disclosing information. So that's, you know, we don't want to chill that. We want to protect that. And in fact, the legislature does something that's really unusual. Happens on occasion, but it's unusual. Tells people, how are we going to read these? What's a reading aid? Sometimes it is this reading aid that the legislature gives us that breaks a case when there's a tie. And that is, the legislature has said that statutes should be liberally construed in aid of the legislative purpose. We don't want to chill this. So how does the legislative purpose and the aid of how we should be interpreting and applying the statute fit into your argument?
Thank you, Your Honor. On the liberal construction point, this is not a foreign concept to the Court and one that this Court has addressed in Hudson. It said that liberal construction does not trump that certain disclosures made a particular way are the ones that are protected. And if we look to the sort of cousin cases of this whistleblower statute, if we look in the healthcare context, what this Court has said in Hausman and Masri even last year in 2014, it said specifically, this Court did, that public policy is not a panacea for perceived shortcomings of legislative determinations. And it is not the place of the Court to redress a perceived shortcoming of the legislature. Now, that gets to the whistleblower cases, and I think there's more than enough direction from Hudson and also Hausman and Masri. But if we go a little broader to your point, that liberal construction is not a foreign concept. It might be rare, but it's not foreign. We can look at the Watkins case, the American Motors case, and its quoting of, I apologize, Laukowitz. And to balance these, it says, liberal construction addresses ambiguous terms. It is not an invitation to rewrite unambiguous ones. So if we have a case, such as in the Fair Employment Act in Watkins, the question was, how should a court interpret whole? When an employee should be made whole, does that include attorney's fees?
And what I agree with your premise that, you know, if the words are clear, end of story. But if there's some need for assistance in interpreting it, then you use the tools of construction. So I don't need to go into those cases because I think they all uniformly say that. Your opposing counsel would suggest that what you are doing is really narrowing the definition that the legislature gave to us of information. Legislature didn't define disclosure, but it did define information. And your opposing counsel asserts that you're writing into this that, for instance, it has to be new information. How do you respond to that? Or information that, I forget, goes to the essence of the conduct or something that you threw in. It seemed to me that that's what they, in part, were complaining about, that rather than liberally interpreting, you're narrowing and writing words into the definitions that don't exist. So respond to that, if you will.
Your Honor, that is not at all what the Department is doing. What the Department is doing is applying the plain language. The newness comes not from the word information. It comes from the word disclose.
Well, talk about a tautology. I mean, you know, come on. Isn't that just as circuitous as information means information?
No, Your Honor. It is that the newness is in the definition of disclose. But if we can take another step about, is the Department asking for anything dramatic here? Not at all. The Department is asking this Court to issue a decision consistent with Kinzel, Kimmett, Kahn, Hoffman. In fact, it's noteworthy that in the reply brief, I believe it's pages 11 and 12 or thereabouts, in footnote 2, Ms. Scheiger tells this Court to look to Hoffman, a federal case, for the definition of disclose. Now, what Ms. Scheiger doesn't tell this Court is that footnote 2 in Hoffman says, quote, to be sure, there may be situations where a government employee reports to the wrongdoer that the conduct of the wrongdoer is unlawful and improper. The wrongdoer, though aware of the conduct, was unaware of its unlawful and impropriety. And then it continues, nonetheless, the report would not be a protected disclosure. So, when Ms. Scheiger is looking for authority, she can find none that supports her interpretation. In fact, she directs you to Hoffman and says, look to it to disclose, doesn't tell you to look at footnote 2. What the Department is asking you to do is follow this Court's ruling in Hudson. Make a person comply with the requirements. We're asking for definitions consistent with Kinzel, consistent with Kimmett, consistent with Kahn, consistent with Hoffman. We are not asking this Court to unduly narrow the statute. We're asking for a plain meaning. And if we can go one further to the second point I wanted to erase since we've already covered the third point, let's look to a word like before, okay? Before is not a difficult word and not one that is difficult to interpret. Now, what the whistleblower statute in 230.81.1a says...
Just a minute.
230.81.1a. It states that before disclosing the information to any person, the employee shall disclose the information to his or her supervisor. Now, a few points that are noteworthy is first the word shall. We don't have to go into all the cases that talk about shall being a mandatory requirement. The point of contention here is whether or not Ms. Scheiger disclosed the information to her supervisor, Malchewski, before disclosing it to another person. Now, if we look to we used Webster's Third International Dictionary, but I think you could find a similar one throughout. Before is prior to. That is to say, it's in advance, preceding something in chronological order. And so before is essentially a chronological conjunctive. It has two components. First, the disclosure cannot be simultaneous. And second, there's a chronological series of events. You do X before Y. All we're asking this Court to do is to give words their common meaning consistent with what the legislature has done, which is carefully balance different competing concerns between the employee and the employee. Now, Ms. Scheiger, in her reply brief, avoids the word before. Doesn't contradict...
Avoids what? I didn't hear.
Avoids the word before. She shifts the focus to supervisor, but she doesn't actually contradict the definition provided by the Department. Now, Ms. Scheiger commits three errors in her reply brief with the word before. First, it's contrary to the facts of the case. If we look to the findings of fact by the administrative law judge in paragraphs 9 and 21, the only supervisor identified is Malchewski. There is no finding of fact that Ms. O'Donnell is a supervisor, and certainly no finding of fact that Sperry is a supervisor. So that's error one. Her reply brief is contrary to the facts of the case. Second, it's contrary to established law. Courts have repeatedly said you cannot sandbag your opponent. If we look to the brief in chief, Ms. Scheiger states and only identifies Malchewski as her supervisor. In fact, on pages 12 and 13, she identifies O'Donnell as an administrator in the Department Division of Management Services, someone outside of DCI who could evaluate her concern. But the third point is, let's assume for the sake of argument Ms. Scheiger has three supervisors, the point she raises in her reply that's not in her brief in chief. It doesn't get her any closer to the result. There's no sequential series of events. If the before requirement is essentially the threshold saying, you have complied with the statute, here is your whistle, now go forth and blow it, Ms. Scheiger never blew it.
How does that comport, again, with the liberal construction to effectuate the policy, your definition of before?
It is a balance between the liberal construction with the point this Court raised in Hudson, which is the whistleblower statutes create specific requirements that must be followed because the legislature is not protecting all disclosures. It has this threshold requirement. Talk to your supervisor before you go out and blow your whistle. So we get a new argument in a reply brief that gets her no closer to her result. In fact, it takes her further away because there is no disclosure after that point. So essentially, her reply says she followed the before requirement, she was given the whistle to blow, and she never blew it. Now, I'd actually want this Court to stick to the facts of the administrative law judge and the argument she makes in her brief in chief, which is essentially acknowledging that all the people she disclosed to knew the information before she ever did anything with it.
Say that again.
The people she disclosed to, Malchuski, Sperry, and O'Donnell, all knew the information before she disclosed it.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have here, Your Honors, is a case that has taken over 100 pages of briefing. It's taking an hour of oral argument. But I got to be honest, this isn't a difficult case. It is a case about five words. It is a case about before, and the phrases reasonably believes and disclosed information. It's a case that was not difficult for the circuit court and not difficult for the appellate court.
Well, how do you, what kind of opinion do you want this court to write?
I would ask this court to have fidelity toward Hudson and confirm that employees have to follow the statutory requirements. I would want this court to interpret phrases consistent and in harmonization. I don't want one definition of disclosed information in 230.80 and a different definition in 230.90, which is what Ms. Scheiger would create. We'd have Kimmitz and Kinzel telling us disclosed information means one thing in 230.90, and then if this court were to adopt her position, it means something else in 230.80. I want consistency in the law, uniformity in the law, and I want this court to simply say the legislature has carefully calibrated these competing interests. Employees can certainly blow the whistle, and Ms. Scheiger can certainly blow the whistle. She simply has to follow the law.
Okay. So, she thinks that use of state employees for a partisan political purpose is a violation of the law. So what did she have to do? Now, the information is known to several people, or many people, right? And you say, hey, once it's open and known, it doesn't fall within 280, right?
I'm sorry, which you're 280?
280.85.
The information.
Yeah.
Isn't that your position?
No, Your Honor, not at all.
Well,
if we look
telling us that your position is if it's widely known, it's not information under 5. That's what your brief says.
Yes, Your Honor, but the point is the requirement we're looking at is the disclosure requirement of 230.81 sub 1. So to answer your question, what could an employee do? The legislature gave the employee lots of opportunities.
Okay, what, you tell me what they are.
So option 1A, and this is in 230.A1, the employer can inform their supervisor in writing. That's the only alleged disclosure in this case. Nothing stopped Ms. Scheiger from doing the one requirements of – I see my red light is on.
You can finish your answer, yes.
Nothing is to stop her from notifying her attorney, her collective bargaining representative, or the legislature. That's an alternative form of disclosure she chose not to use. We also have the 1B disclosures.
Hey, hey, which hey. One says, an employee with knowledge of information, the disclosure of which is not expressly prohibited. Where is her disclosure that he's using, the Attorney General is using state employees for a partisan political event? Where is that disclosure prohibited expressly?
Are you talking about not disclosed by law?
Yeah, I'm looking at 1.8. This is what you rely on. 230.81. Sub 1 says, an employee with knowledge of information, the disclosure of which is not expressly prohibited. Where is it in the statute, state or federal law, rule or regulation, that an employee is prohibited from telling information that is publicly known?
My red light is on. How would the court like
to? You may try to answer the question.
Yeah. Go ahead.
That is not the issue, Your Honor. The issue is Ms. Scheiger has...
The issue is for me, so you have to answer it.
The question is not, could Ms. Scheger have other claims under other statutes? It is not that the department is here to look for a statute that would expressly prohibit it. In my brief, I lay out the six elements. We're not contesting element one about whether it's a lawful or unlawful disclosure. The question, and I apologize for that response, but the point of the department is Ms. Scheger filed the claim. She picked the statute she relied upon, and that is the statute she has to comply with and follow. So it is not that anyone is challenging element one of the six I lay out in my brief. It is that she didn't comply with requirements two, three, and four.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Which are what? Two, three, and four. What are they?
That she disclose information. That's one. The next is that she disclose it to her supervisor before disclosing it to another. And the third is that she has a reasonable belief that it is a violation of a law, rule, or regulation.
I want to talk about reasonable belief for a moment. Reasonable belief, at least generally in the criminal law and probably civil law, you don't look at the subjective belief at all. It's only objective. Why do you think there's a subjective element here?
Your Honor, the specific cases I believe I rely upon in the brief on that point deal with State versus Hampton as a court of appeals decision in the self-defense context, and it does talk about both an objective and subjective component. I believe that's confirmed by things.
I know. And I think if you look at the statute on self-defense, it will show that too. But if you look at probable cause to arrest, or you look at reasonable suspicion to stop, law enforcement officer might have a subjective belief that he can't do it. But if it's objectively reasonable, we can support him. There's no subjective element.
Once again, I've seen the red light and I can maybe respond.
Yeah, it very briefly, and then I'd like you to sit down so that we're not unfair to opposing
counsel.
We can also abide by the red light because there are folks watching us on Wisconsin Eye that can't consent and may feel we're favoring one side or the other. So please go ahead and respond.
I believe the other place in my brief where I address the subjective objective is with federal case law interpreting similar whistleblowing statutes. I believe it's Livingston and Giovanni, but I look to both state law and federal whistleblower statutes. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You may proceed.
Counsel, just so you know, I want to be fair. We had maybe 6 or 7 minutes extra for him, so I'm happy to ask any question that will allow you 6 or 7 minutes to so that it's fair to you.
Yeah, I want to be fair also to the people that watch on Wisconsin Eye, and you all can't consent for everyone that may have a similar issue out there, Justice Abrahamson. So we'll try to abide by the rules we set up when argument began. Please proceed.
Thank you. I want to address a few things, maybe not in the exact order that they were brought up by Attorney Collins, but first, draw attention to the conclusions of law from the administrative law judge. Specifically at page 23 of her order, subsection 4, she ruled that Scheger disclosed information as defined under WSSTAT section 230.80 sub 5. She didn't delineate A and B. She said sub 5. So our position is that that misuse of state resources is still alive in this case.
Okay, thank you.
Furthermore, the disclosure to her supervisors within the chain of command, I give Mr. Collins some credit because he has not been involved in the entirety of this case from the beginning. He has picked it up recently. But we're not sandbagging by saying that she disclosed to individuals within her chain of command. That's been an issue in the case since after the motion for reconsideration was filed by the Department of Justice in the Equal Rights Division. And we've maintained consistently that disclosures to members of her supervisory chain of command fits within the statute, and cases from the Personnel Commission have confirmed that. There is no case that says she only has to disclose it to her supervisor. She can't disclose it to supervisors within her chain of command. And clearly O'Donnell is within her chain of command above Mishevsky, and Sperry was in charge of the security detail that she had been given some assignments on, and that's why she included him on the disclosure.
You cite some other cases from administrative law relating to chain of command and some trial court cases. Should we, what effect do they have on our ruling?
Well, those were personnel commission cases that interpreted the Wisconsin Whistleblower Protection Act.
So, do we give them deference? Is that a reason for giving deference to the administrative law judge?
Absolutely.
So, on the chain of command. Now, there's a charge in here that you have forfeited an argument. What's that about?
The charge that they believed that she disclosed information under the statute and was protected. Is that the second issue that I identified in our petition? Is that what you're referring to, Justice Abramson?
I'm referring to the fact that she forfeited by not raising arguments before the administrative law judge.
I'm not sure which argument you're referring
to. Go ahead.
I do also want to address counsel's reference to Huffman, which we made a reference to in our reply brief. We didn't cite Huffman as authority for how we wanted Shiger's case to be interpreted, but we pointed out that Huffman had a looser definition of the word disclosure than what the Department of Justice was asking for here. And, in fact, we referenced in our brief the fact that Huffman was interpreting a statute that specifically excluded disclosures to a frontline supervisor. We acknowledge that. We just were pointing out the definition was to reveal, not to make secret information known, but to reveal. And the fact of the matter is, as we discussed on, as I discussed in my opening argument, we believe she did fit that statute. Mr. Collins has identified these six factors that really aren't what the statute says. The statute doesn't lay out six factors. It lays out what information is and what needs to be done. The fact of the matter is Ms. Shiger disclosed information to her supervisor and those within her supervisory chain of command. She disclosed information that she reasonably believed demonstrated a violation of law. She attached the specific violation that she thought was implicated by what they were doing, and she asked them to forward it up the chain of command to try and prevent it from happening. I don't know how she could fit within the statute. I don't care what definition they want to make for disclosure or information. The fact of the matter is she fits. She fits the statute. She couldn't fit in any better, in my opinion. The cases that they've cited, from Hudson to Kinzel to Kmetz, they involve completely disparate facts and, in fact, involve different statutes. But regardless, Kinzel involved a dispute about someone being terminated. And this particular employee wrote a disparaging letter to his supervisor and said, I disagree with you terminating these individuals. That's not what happened here. Kmetz involved a dispute about a name change. I don't agree with a name change for the State Historical Society. Okay, that person was not determined to make anything known because the name change was known already. She wasn't saying that the name change was unlawful or a misuse of state resources or an abuse of state resources. The complainant in that case was saying, I disagree with it. That kind of opinion, and getting back to the question that Justice Gableman asked before, how can we differentiate between an opinion and a belief like this? Well, the difference between the two cases, between Shiger and between Kmetz, really shows how you can differentiate between that. I believe that this name change is a bad idea. I don't agree with it. That's an opinion that shouldn't be protected under the Whistleblower Protection Act, and it wasn't. I believe that we're going to be violating a law by doing what you say we should do. That should be protected. And it should be protected because that otherwise we give a supervisor a green light to retaliate at will against an employee. And that's exactly what happened here. We have a supervisor who admitted that one of the reasons he didn't pass her on probation is because she raised what he believed to be illegitimate concerns about the Republican convention. Well, I mean, he can't even get that part right. The fact of the matter is she was trying to prevent an unlawful activity, did so diplomatically, and he was mad about it.
Thank you, counsel.
Can I make one more point? One of the issues we have not addressed here today is the issue that the Department of Justice believed Joelle Shiger fit within the statute. And the statute protects employees in situations where the employer believes she made a lawful disclosure. And that was not fully developed in the underlying case, but nevertheless, as indicated in the brief, there's a lot of evidence that indicates that's exactly what they did. They believed she had. It was not until after the administrative law judge ruled on liability, so gave a final decision on liability, that they raised this idea that she didn't disclose information under the statute and therefore didn't fit within the Whistleblower Protection Act. But if they believed she had, she still would fit within that protection. And one of the points we're raising here on appeal is, does the statute protect individuals when the employer believes they disclosed information under the statute? And I know I'm past my time, so I just ask the justices to look at that section in the brief, because it was briefed, and the evidence does support it.
Good. Thank you very much.
Is this 8C that you're talking about?
Pardon me?
Is this 8C that you're talking about?
Under the statute?
Yes. And that talks, if it's 8C.
Precisely.
Yes,
Judge.
That talks about the appointing authority or supervisor believes. It doesn't say reasonably believes. It just says believes. Does that make it different than the information which the employee reasonably believes?
Well, I think what that statute is doing is it's similar to other statutes where, you know, if someone engages in protected activity, but that activity is not necessarily protected under the statute, but the employer believes that that person did engage in protected activity and retaliates, they're protected. And it's clear from the evidence in this case that the Department of Justice, Mr. Mischewski, and others within that whole supervisory chain of command believed that Ms. Shiger disclosed information that would have warranted protection under
the
statute.
Thank you, Counsel.
And thank you, Justices.
Thank you both for very, very good arguments and helping us to better understand the interesting case. We will be adjourning to meet in closed conference at 3:15. We are adjourned. Thank you.